Chapter 4. We all dined together that day, and a rather formidable party we were. No fewer than 86 strong. The vessel being pretty deep in the water, with all her coals on board, and so many passengers, and the weather being calm and quiet, there was but little motion, so that before the dinner was half over, even those passengers who were most distrustful of themselves plucked up amazingly. And those who in the morning had returned to the universal question, "Are you a good sailor?" A very decided negative, now either parried the inquiry with the evasive reply, "Oh, I suppose I'm no worse than anybody else," or, reckless of all moral obligations, answered boldly yes, and with some irritation too, as though they would add, "I should like to know what you see in me, sir, particularly, to justify suspicion." Notwithstanding this high tone of courage and confidence, I could not but observe that very few remained long over their wine, and that everybody had an unusual love of the open air, and that the favorite and most coveted seats were invariably those nearest to the door. The tea table, too, was by no means as well attended as the dinner table, and there was less whist playing than might have been expected. Still, with the exception of one lady, who had retired with some precipitation at dinner time, immediately after being assisted to the finest cut of a very yellow boiled leg of mutton with very green capers, there were no invalids as yet, and walking, and smoking, and drinking of brandy and water, but always in the open air, went on with unabated spirit, until 11 o'clock or thereabouts, when turning in no sailor of 7 hours' experience talks of going to bed became the order of the night. The perpetual tramp of boot heels on the decks gave place to a heavy silence, and the whole human freight was stowed away below, excepting a very few stragglers, like myself, who were probably, like me, afraid to go there. To one unaccustomed to such scenes, this is a very striking time on shipboard. Afterwards, and when its novelty had long worn off, it never ceased to have a peculiar interest and charm for me. The gloom through which the great black mass holds its direct and certain course, the rushing water, plainly heard, but dimly seen, the broad, white, glistening track that follows in the vessel's wake, the men on the lookout forward, who would be scarcely visible against the dark sky, but for their blotting out some score of glistening stars, the helmsman at the wheel, with the illuminated card before him, shining, a speck of light amidst the darkness, like something sentient, and of divine intelligence, the melancholy sighing of the wind through block, and rope, and chain, the gleaming forth of light from every crevice, nook, and tiny piece of glass about the decks, as though the ship were filled with fire in hiding, ready to burst through any outlet, wild with its resistless power of death and ruin. At first too, and even when the hour, and all the objects it exalts, have come to be familiar, it is difficult, alone and thoughtful, to hold them to their proper shapes and forms. They change with the wandering fancy, assume the semblance of things left far away, put on the well-remembered aspect of favorite places dearly loved, and even people them with shadows, streets, houses, rooms, figures so like their usual occupants, that they have startled me by their reality, which far exceeded, as it seemed to me, all power of mine, to conjure up the absent, have, many and many a time, at such an hour, grown suddenly out of objects with whose real look, and use, and purpose, I was as well acquainted, as with my own two hands. My own two hands, and feet likewise, being very cold, however, on this particular occasion, I crept below at midnight. It was not exactly comfortable below. It was decidedly close, and it was impossible to be unconscious of the presence of that extraordinary compound of strange smells, which is to be found nowhere but on board ship, and which is such a subtle perfume, that it seems to enter at every pore of the skin, and whisper of the hold. Two passengers' wives, one of them my own, lay already in silent agonies on the sofa, And one lady's maid, my lady's, was a mere bundle on the floor, execrating her destiny, and pounding her curl papers among the stray boxes. Everything sloped the wrong way, which in itself was an aggravation scarcely to be borne. I had left the door open, a moment before, in the bosom of a gentle declivity, and, when I turned to shut it, it was on the summit of a lofty eminence. Now every plank and timber creaked, as if the ship were made of wicker work, and now crackled, like an enormous fire of the driest possible twigs. There was nothing for it but bed, so I went to bed. It was pretty much the same for the next 2 days, with a tolerably fair wind and dry weather. I read in bed, but to this hour I don't know what, a good deal, and reeled on deck a little, drank cold brandy and water with an unspeakable disgust, and ate hard biscuit perseveringly. Not ill, but going to be. It is the third morning. I am awakened out of my sleep by a dismal shriek from my wife, who demands to know whether there's any danger. I rouse myself, and look out of bed. The water jug is plunging and leaping like a lively dolphin. All the smaller articles are afloat, except my shoes, which are stranded on a carpet bag, high and dry, like a couple of coal barges. Suddenly I see them spring into the air, and behold the looking glass, which is nailed to the wall, sticking fast upon the ceiling. At the same time the door entirely disappears, and a new one is opened in the floor. Then I begin to comprehend that the stateroom is standing on its head. Before it is possible to make any arrangement at all compatible with this novel state of things, the ship writes. Before one can say thank heaven, apostrophe apostrophe she wrongs again. Before one can cry she is wrong, she seems to have started forward, and to be a creature actually running of its own accord, with broken knees and failing legs, through every variety of hole and pitfall, and stumbling constantly. Before one can, so much as wonder, she takes a high leap into the air. Before she has well done that, she takes a deep dive into the water. Before she has gained the surface, she throws a somerset. The instant she is on her legs, she rushes backward. And so she goes on staggering, heaving, wrestling, leaping, diving, jumping, pitching, throbbing, rolling, and rocking. And going through all these movements, sometimes by turns, and sometimes altogether, until one feels disposed to roar for mercy. A steward passes. Steward. Apostrophe, sir? What is the matter? What do you call this? Apostrophe, apostrophe, rather a heavy sea on, sir, and a headwind. Apostrophe, a headwind. Imagine a human face upon the vessel's prow, with 15,000 Samsons in one bent upon driving her back, and hitting her exactly between the eyes, whenever she attempts to advance an inch. Imagine the ship herself, with every pulse and artery of her huge body swollen and bursting under this maltreatment, sworn to go on or die. Imagine the wind howling, the sea roaring, the rain beating, all in furious array against her. Picture the sky both dark and wild, and the clouds, in fearful sympathy with the waves, making another ocean in the air. Add to all this, the clattering on deck and down below, the tread of hurried feet, the loud hoarse shouts of seamen, the gurgling in and out of water through the scuppers, with, every now and then, the striking of a heavy sea upon the planks above, with the deep, dead, heavy sound of thunder heard within a vault. And there is the headwind of that January morning. I say nothing of what may be called the domestic noises of the ship, such as the breaking of glass and crockery, the tumbling down of stewards, the gambles, overhead, of loose casks and truant dozens of bottled porter, and the very remarkable and far from exhilarating sounds raised in their various staterooms by the 70 passengers who were too ill to get up to breakfast. I say nothing of them. For although I lay listening to this concert for 3 or 4 days, I don't think I heard it for more than a quarter of a minute, at the expiration of which term, I lay down again, excessively seasick. Not seasick, be it understood, in the ordinary acceptation of the term. I wish I had been. but in a form which I have never seen or heard described, though I have no doubt it is very common. I lay there, all the day long, quite coolly and contentedly, with no sense of weariness, with no desire to get up, or get better, or take the air, with no curiosity, or care, or regret, of any sort or degree, saving that I think I can remember, in this universal indifference, having a kind of lazy joy of fiendish delight, if anything so lethargic can be dignified with the title, in the fact of my wife being too ill to talk to me. If I may be allowed to illustrate my state of mind by such an example, I should say that I was exactly in the condition of the elder Mr. Willett after the incursion of the rioters into his bar at Chigwell. Nothing would have surprised me if, in the momentary illumination of any ray of intelligence that may have come upon me in the way of thoughts of home, a goblin postman, with a scarlet coat and bell, had come into that little kennel before me, broad awake in broad day, and, apologizing for being damp through walking in the sea, had handed me a letter directed to myself, in familiar characters. I am certain I should not have felt one atom of astonishment. I should have been perfectly satisfied. If Neptune himself had walked in, with a toasted shark on his trident, I should have looked upon the event as one of the very commonest everyday occurrences. Once I found myself on deck. I don't know how I got there, or what possessed me to go there, but there I was, and completely dressed too, with a huge pea coat on, and a pair of boots such as no weak man in his senses could ever have got into. I found myself standing, when a gleam of consciousness came upon me, holding on to something. I don't know what. I think it was the boatswain. Or it may have been the pump. Or possibly the cow. I can't say how long I had been there, whether a day or a minute. I recollect trying to think about something, about anything in the whole wide world. I was not particular, without the smallest effect. I could not even make out which was the sea, and which the sky, for the horizon seemed drunk, and was flying wildly about in all directions. Even in that incapable state, however, I recognized the lazy gentleman standing before me, nautically clad in a suit of shaggy blue, with an oilskin hat. But I was too imbecile, although I knew it to be, to separate him from his dress, and tried to call him, I remember, pilot. After another interval of total unconsciousness, I found he had gone, and recognized another figure in its place. It seemed to wave and fluctuate before me, as though I saw it reflected in an unsteady looking glass, but I knew it for the captain, and such was the cheerful influence of his face, that I tried to smile. Yes, even then I tried to smile. I saw by his gestures that he addressed me. But it was a long time before I could make out that he remonstrated against my standing up to my knees in water as I was. Of course I don't know why. I tried to thank him, but couldn't. I could only point to my boots, or wherever I supposed my boots to be, and say in a plaintive voice, "Cork soles." At the same time endeavoring, I am told, to sit down in the pool. Finding that I was quite insensible, and for the time a maniac, he humanely conducted me below. There I remained until I got better. Suffering, whenever I was recommended to eat anything, an amount of anguish only second to that which is said to be endured by the apparently drowned, in the process of restoration to life. One gentleman on board had a letter of introduction to me from a mutual friend in London. He sent it below with his card, on the morning of the head wind, and I was long troubled with the idea that he might be up, and well, and 100 times a day expecting me to call upon him in the saloon. I imagined him one of those cast iron images I will not call them men who ask, with red faces, and lusty voices, what seasickness means, and whether it really is as bad as it is represented to be. This was very torturing indeed. And I don't think I ever felt such perfect gratification and gratitude of heart as I did when I heard from the ship's doctor that he had been obliged to put a large mustard poultice on this very gentleman's stomach. I date my recovery from the receipt of that intelligence. It was materially assisted, though, I have no doubt, by a heavy gale of wind, which came slowly up at sunset, when we were about 10 days out, and raged with gradually increasing fury until morning, saving that it lulled for an hour a little before midnight. There was something in the unnatural repose of that hour, and in the after-gathering of the storm, so inconceivably awful and tremendous, that its bursting into full violence was almost a relief. The laboring of the ship in the troubled sea on this night I shall never forget. Will it ever be worse than this? Apostrophe was a question I had often heard asked, when everything was sliding and bumping about, and when it certainly did seem difficult to comprehend the possibility of anything afloat being more disturbed, without toppling over and going down. But what the agitation of a steam vessel is, on a bad winter's night in the wild Atlantic, it is impossible for the most vivid imagination to conceive. To say that she is flung down on her side in the waves, with her masts dipping into them, and that, springing up again, she rolls over on the other side, until a heavy sea strikes her with the noise of 100 great guns, and hurls her back that she stops, and staggers, and shivers, as though stunned, and then, with a violent throbbing at her heart, darts onward like a monster goaded into madness, to be beaten down, and battered, and crushed, and leaped on by the angry sea that thunder, lightning, hail, and rain, and wind, are all in fierce contention for the mastery, that every plank has its groan, every nail its shriek, and every drop of water in the great ocean its howling voice is nothing. To say that all is grand, and all appalling and horrible in the last degree, is nothing. Words cannot express it. Thoughts cannot convey it. Only a dream can call it up again, in all its fury, rage, and passion. And yet, in the very midst of these terrors, I was placed in a situation so exquisitely ridiculous, that even then I had as strong a sense of its absurdity as I have now, and could no more help laughing than I can at any other comical incident, happening under circumstances the most favorable to its enjoyment. About midnight we shipped a sea, which forced its way through the skylights, burst open the doors above, and came raging and roaring down into the ladies' cabin, to the unspeakable consternation of my wife, and a little Scotch lady who, by the way, had previously sent a message to the captain by the stewardess, requesting him, with her compliments, to have a steel conductor immediately attached to the top of every mast, and to the chimney, in order that the ship might not be struck by lightning. They and the handmaid before mentioned, being in such ecstasies of fear, that I scarcely knew what to do with them, I naturally bethought myself of some restorative or comfortable cordial, and nothing better occurring to me, at the moment, than hot brandy and water, I procured a tumbler full without delay. It being impossible to stand or sit without holding on, they were all heaped together in one corner of a long sofa, a fixture extending entirely across the cabin, where they clung to each other in momentary expectation of being drowned. When I approached this place with my specific, and was about to administer it with many consolatory expressions to the nearest sufferer, what was my dismay, to see them all roll slowly down to the other end. And when I staggered to that end, and held out the glass once more, how immensely baffled were my good intentions by the ship giving another lurch, and they're all rolling back again. I suppose I dodged them up and down this sofa for at least a quarter of an hour, without reaching them once, and by the time I did catch them, the brandy and water was diminished, by constant spilling, to a teaspoonful. To complete the group, it is necessary to recognize in this disconcerted dodger, an individual very pale from seasickness, who had shaved his beard, and brushed his hair, last, at Liverpool, and whose only article of dress, linen not included, were a pair of dreadnought trousers, a blue jacket, formerly admired upon the Thames at Richmond, no stockings, and one slipper. Of the outrageous antics performed by that ship next morning, which made bed a practical joke, and getting up, by any process short of falling out, an impossibility. I say nothing. But anything like the utter dreariness and desolation that met my eyes when I literally tumbled upon deck at noon, I never saw. Ocean and sky were all of one dull, heavy, uniform, lead color. There was no extent of prospect even over the dreary waste that lay around us, for the sea ran high, and the horizon encompassed us like a large black hoop. Viewed from the air, or some tall bluff on shore, it would have been imposing and stupendous, no doubt, but seen from the wet and rolling decks, it only impressed one giddily and painfully. In the gale of last night the lifeboat had been. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.